welcome back to Dead Wrong. My name is Elizabeth, but you can call me Liz, and I'll be your host. Today we'll be talking about the murder of Jamie Stice and the abduction of her 8-month-old baby, Isaiah. Fair warning, this case is gruesome in more ways than one, so proceed with caution. It's really interesting to see the role that the internet and Facebook get to play in this case, as Jamie is completely charmed by a manipulative perpetrator that weaves her way into Jamie's family, only to commit a heinous crime. Jamie Stice was from Bowling Green, Kentucky, and only 21 years old when she announced her pregnancy to her mother, Jeannie Stice. Hesitant and afraid to feel the wrath her mother might pour out at the news, Jamie was surprised to receive her mother's support. The baby's father was Jamie's boyfriend at the time, 23-year-old James Reynolds, who she'd been dating for about 2 years. James had been married previously, and because of this, he didn't want to pressure Jamie into marriage just because of her pregnancy. But Jamie was excited to be a mom. Despite her young age, she was thrilled. But the truth is, neither James nor Jamie were financially stable to provide for a child. But Jamie pushed on, confident that they would find a way to figure things out. Eric Stice, Jamie's brother, was quick to share his concerns with Jamie, not only about her financial instability, but also on how large of a responsibility a child really is. Jamie's childhood was marked by her parents' divorce when she was only 2 years old. Jamie's mother, Jeannie, eventually met Mike, who became Jamie's stepfather. Jeannie described their relationship as neutral, for lack of a better word. They didn't fight or argue. They lived with each other in a shared space and respected one another. This is huge, because blending two families, or even introducing a stepfather or a stepmother, can sometimes lead to some pretty nasty reactions from hormonal teenagers. But this wasn't the case with Jamie. She was kind, understanding, and ultimately prioritized her mother's happiness. Like most people Jamie's age, in 2011, she was obsessed with Facebook. After sharing the news with her mother, Jamie quickly took to Facebook to announce her pregnancy to her closest friends and family. Many congratulated her and wished her well in this new chapter. One of her close friends, Kelly, recalls Jamie using this pregnancy tracker that was available on Facebook at the time. It let the mom know what size the baby was at different milestones, and even when the baby began to grow fingers and toes. There are a ton of applications similar to this available for moms-to-be that are still used today, ones that highlight the size of the baby, and even compare it to fruit, like avocado and papaya. Jamie began to picture this future for herself, and really started to take initiative. See, she dreamed of working with children, and thought that being a social worker was the perfect fit. She started filling out applications for different programs to earn the certification she would need to accomplish her career goal. This was in the first few weeks of her pregnancy. Around the same time is when James, the baby's father, lost his job. James was known for juggling temporary jobs and never really maintaining a steady income. But he reassured Jeannie that he would try to pick up some shifts from a buddy of his, and was really focused on finding something else. Fast forward. Jamie is delighted to share with her friends and family on Facebook her first sonogram that confirms the gender, a boy. Going back and forth between names, Jamie and James settle on Isaiah, which means son of God. Jamie slowly started to notice James's shift as the weeks went on, and he began to show little to no interest in the pregnancy. He was frustrated with Jamie's fantasy, of having a little family and being financially stable enough to provide for their child, to buy him toys and playsets. It simply wasn't realistic. Not long after James lost his job, Jeannie and Mike soon met the same fate. With all three of the providers in the Stice home out of a job, Jamie was beyond worried. She was concerned about her child's future. What would he be born into? This uncertainty was mixed with the uncomfortable feeling of becoming larger as the baby continued growing inside her. Jamie became more and more limited as to what she could do and where she could go. And being that she was only 21, most of her friends were working or in school. She started to feel isolated, lost, left without anyone to talk to. She spent her days at home, longing for company or some sort of engagement. I'm sure this is a feeling we're all used to by now, at least to some extent, as quarantine has left us sheltered in our homes. Jamie was seeking friendship, as her baby's father was absent and financial constraints continued to weigh on her. It's here that Jamie takes to Facebook and posts continuously about her pregnancy and her excitement for her baby to finally arrive. While feeling down about her situation, she receives a friend request from a woman, Kathy Coy. Unfamiliar with the name at first, she receives a direct message. Kathy highlights the fact that Jamie is expecting and explains that she too is due at around the same time as Jamie. Still unsure of who exactly Kathy is, Jamie responds by asking how she might know her. Kathy explains that she is Becca's cousin. And indeed, she's friends with Becca on Facebook, so it seems her story checks out. But who is Becca? Jeannie, Jamie's mother, doesn't really specify if there's any familial relationship with Rebecca Daniels, but she clarifies that she's known her for almost her entire life. So Jamie thinks that she's taken all the right precautions before beginning a conversation with what seems like a total stranger. She verifies that they have mutual friends, and she is more desperate than ever to communicate with someone who's experiencing the exact same thing. Kathy lives about 30 miles away in Morgantown. She's 33 years old and claims to be happily married to Shannon Coy. She's the mother of two children while expecting her third. The friendship between the two women blossoms quickly. It gives Jamie a new friend, someone who understands, someone she can really confide in about all her mommy worries, someone who's done it all before, twice, and knows exactly what to expect. Jamie's trusting heart takes over, and she allows whatever hesitance inhabited her before to slip away. They not only share their pregnancies in common, but also their relationship issues. Jamie voices her concerns about James's recent absence and the worry that she might have to do this all alone. While Kathy shares stories of her husband Shannon constantly traveling for business and never being home. They take comfort in this, in sharing their loneliness with one another, grateful for their companionship. Jamie shares the news of her mother and stepfather's recent unemployment with Kathy. And Kathy, being the great friend that she is, steps right in. She offers to help her with shopping for baby clothes, mentioning the friend that she knows that owns a baby clothes store and is going out of business. Kathy even offers cash. Again, blinded by trust, Jamie is thankful for her friend Kathy and willing to accept her help in light of her financial situation. As her due date approaches, Jamie is feeling the weight of the reality of bringing a child into this world and fears she may not be prepared. Limited to what she can do and where she can go, she feels helpless. She has no way to even attempt to make some sort of money to provide for her baby. She has no choice but to sit still and wait. So she grasps onto any life raft that is thrown her way. And in this case, Kathy is that life raft, conveniently showing up at the right time and offering exactly what Jamie needs right when she needs it. Soon enough, Jamie invites Kathy over. Jamie and her mother are both there to greet Kathy for the first time. Jeannie describes her as kind and a bit loud because she is deaf in one ear, but overall kind. Becca, the mutual tie between the Stice family and Kathy, explained to Jeannie that as a child, Kathy was frequently bullied because of her impairment. Children would make fun of her because she talked a bit louder than the rest just to be able to hear herself. This detail only furthered the kind portrayal of Kathy. Their first meeting revolves around Jamie's desire to have a baby shower, but the realization that she simply can't afford it, not with her current financial situation. And of course, Kathy, being the great friend that she is, offers to throw one for Jamie and insist that she let her. Jamie is overwhelmed with the presence of someone who is willing to help her in the absence of James, that she begins to feel some of the weight lifted off her shoulders. She begins to feel like she isn't in this alone. With an impromptu baby shower in the making, Kathy begins to spend more time at the Stice home to go over the details of the event. Her visits soon include gifts, like baby clothes, shoes, or little accessories that she just thought would be perfect for Isaiah. And even cash for Jeannie to help with the electric and water bills, sometimes even rent. To Jeannie and Jamie, Kathy is a complete blessing, a blessing they truly needed during such a pressing time. And just like that, Kathy is in the Stice home every day. Yes, every day. Kathy is inside the home of Jeannie and Jamie Stice. She is weaving herself into their lives. While researching, it's at this point that I began to ask myself if anyone noticed anything strange about Kathy, or questioned the sudden close bond shared between the two. Jamie's close friend Kelly says she wasn't thrilled about their online friendship and questioned Kathy's intentions. But it's difficult to question or even point out red flags to someone who is so blinded by the kindness and generosity Kathy offered. I mean, how do you tell someone who's been abandoned by her ex-boyfriend, can't work because of how far along she is with her pregnancy, and is only in further financial turmoil because her mother and stepfather are out of a job, that the only person who is offering to help her is kind of off or sketchy or weird? You can't. You just come off as jealous or mean for not wanting the best for her. Remember that friend of Kathy's, the one that owned a baby clothes shop and was going out of business? Well, Kathy makes plans for her and Jamie to go to the store to pick up some pieces that her friend has already set aside for Isaiah. Kathy offers to drive Jeannie to the Social Security office so she can file for disability, and then plans on taking Jamie to the baby store afterwards. Jamie is now almost 8 months pregnant, and Kathy is not far ahead of her, as she is expecting soon as well. At around 9:30 a.m. on April 13th, 2011, Kathy picks up Jeannie, and they begin to make their way to the Social Security office. After dropping Jeannie off at the Social Security office, Kathy decides she'll go pick up Jamie while she's waiting for Jeannie, because she figures her appointment will probably take a while, and the office is only about a 15-minute drive or so from the Stice home. Jeannie's appointment does take longer than she expected, but after about an hour, Kathy is nowhere to be found. Jeannie receives a text message from Kathy that says she's gone into labor and needs to go straight to the hospital. So Jeannie decides to call her brother and asks if he can give her a ride home, which he does. When she gets home at around 12:30 p.m., She knocks on the door and shouts for Jamie to open it up for her, as she had left her keys in Kathy's car, because she figured she would be the one taking her home. Jeannie assumes that if Kathy is in the hospital, then Jamie must be home, but to no avail. She calls Mike, and he rushes home to let her in. They think maybe Jamie fell asleep, or maybe she's upstairs taking a shower. But Jamie's nowhere to be found. Jeannie decides to try calling Kathy, but her calls go unanswered, as expected, because she's in labor. In an act of desperation, Jeannie turns to Facebook and makes a post asking if anyone has heard from or seen Jamie. But again, nothing. While waiting nervously for her daughter to return home, Jeannie receives a call from Kathy, exclaiming that she's given birth to a beautiful baby boy. Jeannie tries her best to sound congratulatory over the phone, but can't help but ask if Kathy knows where Jamie is. Kathy says she dropped Jamie off at home before heading to the hospital. It's clear Kathy has her hands full with her newborn baby, so Jeannie lets her go and continues to wait. She calls Jamie dozens of times, leaving her voicemail after voicemail, pleading for her to just return her call, to tell her everything's okay. Jeannie never gets a call. Instead, she gets a knock at her door, 14 hours after Jamie was last seen. She's confused when she sees officers on her front doorstep. They begin questioning her immediately about Jamie's relationship with Kathy. Jeannie confirms that they were friends and says she was close to calling the police herself because she hasn't seen her daughter since early this morning. Without skipping a beat, the police officers return to the detective in charge and relay the new development. Kathy and Jamie were close friends, and Jamie is missing. Okay, let's back it up. After Kathy dropped Jeannie off at the Social Security office, she did go back and pick up Jamie, but they didn't go baby shopping at her friend's store. Kathy began the drive down State Road 68, where she pulled over and used a stun gun to incapacitate Jamie. She then proceeded to bind Jamie's wrists together before slitting her throat and wrist. Kathy then used a drywall knife to cut the baby out of Jamie. With the baby in hand, Kathy drove to a friend's house and honked for the friend to come outside. She then showed her the baby and asked her to take a quick picture of the two of them so she could send it to her husband, Shannon, who was out of town on business. The friend claims Kathy didn't have any pants on and was sitting on top of the placenta and other female organs while holding the baby in her lap that had visible pieces of grass on him. Shortly after, an ambulance arrived to transport Kathy from Butler County, where her friend lived, to a hospital in Bowling Green. It was here that nurses grew suspicious over the baby's birth. As you might have suspected, Kathy showed no signs that she had just given birth. There was no blood. Kathy brought with her alleged placenta, uterus, ovaries, and umbilical cord in a bucket. The odd thing, one doctor pointed out, was that the organs seemed to have been cut out, not pulled or torn, in the way they might have been in some sort of amateur attempt at giving birth in your car. Hospital staff quickly contacted the police and relayed their suspicions. Isaiah had been separated from Kathy as he was born 5 weeks premature. Police questioned Kathy, and after she failed to cooperate, she was driven to the station where she was pressed for answers by the police. They obtained a search warrant for Kathy's home and began scrolling through her computer history when they came across 3 different Facebook profiles that had all been left open on her desktop. All 3 profiles were of pregnant women, one of them being Jamie Stice. While detectives continued to search Kathy's home for evidence, Police officers were dispatched to the homes of the three women, and this is how officers landed on the front steps of the Stice home at around 11 p.m., where Jeannie confirmed the friendship between Jamie and Kathy and the recent disappearance of her daughter. Detectives leaned into this lead and asked Kathy if the baby was Jamie's. Her story faltered, and at first, she stuck to the story that the baby was hers. Once she realized that there was no evidence of her giving birth and that that would be almost impossible to defy, she ran with the story that another woman killed Jamie and sold the baby to her for $550. Detectives still didn't buy her story. They asked Kathy who Jamie is, and at first, she claimed she doesn't know the woman. They reveal to Kathy that they have connected Jamie to Kathy's Facebook. They ask Kathy who Jamie is, and at first, she claims she doesn't know the woman. They reveal to Kathy that they have connected Jamie to Kathy's Facebook. And she admits. She admits to murdering her and taking her baby boy. When asked where they could find Jamie's body, Kathy directs them to a wooded area off of State Road 68. And as she leads them to the spot where Jamie's body lays, she warns them of the gruesome nature her body has been left in. The next morning, the police arrive once more on the front steps of the Stice home bearing bad news. Jeannie collapses, feeling the ground under her give way. She's not permitted to see Jamie because of the state of her body. And that, somehow, that only makes it harder. Next to Jamie's body, police find two knives and the stun gun that was used to stun Jamie. The stun gun was reportedly bought only a week earlier at a local flea market with one of Kathy's children. Kathy lied about expecting a child. And she lied about her husband, Shannon. Kathy is a twice-divorced mother of two teenagers. Kathy befriended Jamie and two other pregnant women in an attempt to abduct their baby as a way to rekindle her lost relationship with her latest ex-husband, Shannon Coy. Kathy revealed to her 13-year-old daughter that she in fact suffered a miscarriage and needed her to help her kidnap a baby. Her daughter refused. She asked the same of her 14-year-old son, who also refused. And upon refusal, Kathy claimed it was just a joke. During her trial, there was no evidence to substantiate the claim that she did have a miscarriage. To avoid the death penalty, Kathy pleads guilty, but mentally ill. A psychologist did testify during the trial to validate the mental illness claim made by the defense and confirm that Kathy was suffering from some sort of mental illness. The premeditation is clear. Kathy had convinced her neighbors that she was pregnant for months, and in October of 2010, she even stole a sonogram to share with her friends as proof of her pregnancy. She was obsessed with having another child and convinced herself that it was the key to saving her last failed marriage. Infant kidnappers have been profiled as typically women who are of childbearing age and are in some sort of rocky relationship that they believe can only be saved with the birth of a child. They'll often hint to their partner that they might be pregnant, when in fact, they're planning on taking another woman's fetus. It is their belief that a pregnancy will keep their significant other in the picture out of obligation to the child. Kathy never saw Jamie as a person, or a woman, or a mother-to-be. She saw Jamie as the bearer of her unborn child. It came as a surprise to me to learn that this murder and abduction was not the first. It's actually the 14th fetal abduction in the United States since November 1974. Of the 25 fetal abductions to date, Only 13 of the fetuses have survived, and Isaiah Allen Stice Reynolds is one of them. Yes, Isaiah did survive, although it was definitely a close call. Not only was he 5 weeks premature, but when a mother dies before the baby is born, the heart stops. And if the baby isn't removed quickly, it'll die. Isaiah now lives with his father full time and is surrounded by a family that will make sure he knows who his mother was. Kathy Coy is serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Remember to follow the podcast on Instagram and Twitter at DeadWrongPod. There you can find exclusive episode content like pictures from today's case. You can always leave a rating or review on the podcast page. Again, this has been Dead Wrong. And my name is Elizabeth, but you get to call me.